the great thing about the movie is that everyone gets to be terrible and wonderful at the same time, which is normal. You know, like, it's like the most normal to be terrible and wonderful at the same time. Everyone is.
This is Faux Real, a podcast where I chat with indie filmmakers about their filmmaking processes, their inspirations, and what their stories mean to them. And I'm your host, Dawn Borchardt. On this episode of Faux Real, I sit down with filmmaker Madsen Minax for his film North by Current.
My name is Angelo Madsen Minax, and I just go by Madsen, my middle name. I made a film called North by Currents. It's a portrait of a rural family in the Midwest trying to figure out how they can relate to each other in the present in the wake of really divergent pasts. The film begins with me kind of returning home to Michigan, to my rural hometown, after my niece's death and my brother-in-law's wrongful incarceration for her presumed murder, which is later acquitted and found to be accidental. But that's sort of the springboard that the film kind of begins from to explore the more tangential threads of relationality in my family structure. But that incident, Kel's death, my niece, and my brother-in-law's incarceration are the things that take me home to start the sort of journey, as it were. And then throughout the film, like, there's all kinds of tangential threads that weave together to explore these large themes of like rural masculinity and trans identity and religiosity and the sort of textures in between, the semblances that overlap between like sexuality and religion or between location and politics.
This film is so incredibly personal. And when I was watching it, I just kept thinking about you and like what this process must have been like for you. It's mostly emotionally making this, not really the filmmaking process itself. But at what point did you decide to make a film about your story and your family's relationships?
I didn't really start thinking about filming until a couple of years after my niece's death, around the time my brother-in-law was released. And when I went into the project, I thought it might be a little bit more either super experimental with like all landscape portraits and voiceover, or like either a little bit more conventional, maybe something that could be used as like a prison abolition tool or something like this, or a piece that could kind of like crack open some of the politics of like rural whiteness and the police state. And, you know, the film does that slightly in subtext, you know, but it's obviously a very different film. You know, I am a big fan of working with what the footage tells you to do. And I'm also not much of a storyteller in a sort of classic sense. Like, I don't come to filmmaking from the idea that there's like a good story to be told. I come to art making from the idea that there are like many ways of looking at the world and ideas that intersect with experience that are interesting to me that don't necessarily have to do with stories. So when I talk about my work, I talk about my work like ideas I'm interested in exploring more so than stories I'm interested in exploring. Part of that is that like I often work non-narratively, and I don't think that story is actually essential to have an interesting cinematic experience. So, I mean, this idea of this film is very narrative. It's one of the most narrative films I've ever made. And bringing that concept of story to it was sort of like my way to make a film that would be more accessible to a wider audience, basically. I mean, as I was shooting, you know, things were constantly in flux. Situations were happening, whether it was like, you know, narrative situations, like someone is having a hard time with substances, or, you know, someone is in an altercation, or someone is, you know, a child, like something is awry, trauma is happening actively, or whether it was like more subtle stuff, like, you know, my interests shifting or whatever. And, you know, like, and I think my interests shifted a lot during the course of this film because, again, because of what the footage was allowing. So like, you know, for example, my sister was really not interested in talking to me about Kala's death or the court case or any of that. And so a lot of that storytelling happens in the retelling. And then, you know, like David, he was very interested in the project for a couple of years and then was very not interested in the project. You know, there's obviously like things that like shift and change during the course of a production that's 6 years long. I knew that my position, my subjecthood would always be part of the film. Because I usually work auto-ethnographically and like work with personal experience in most of my projects, even if it's only through subtext and not like through direct kind of surface content. But I didn't know like it would be like such an integral part, like in terms of like exposition.
There's some things that I thought of while you're explaining kind of your sense of structure or even lack thereof, and like non-narrative backgrounds. And it just made me think about like a lot of non-narrative, more experimental work and memory-based, the way like our brain processes those being similar in that often we come away remembering how we feel versus sure. like actual
totally
events or, you know, facts. And so that's interesting to hear you talk about it that way, because I'm just like, that style of filmmaking, I feel like, is maybe more representative of how we actually like internally process things. And I come from an experimental film background. I went to experimental film school in Milwaukee. So,
oh, UW?
Yeah, I did. So
that's a great school.
Mm-hmm. So when I saw like your film, I was like,
filmmakers in the Midwest come from Milwaukee.
Yes, we do. I really liked bringing together this theme of like loss and the different things that you just described. And can you talk about like kind of at what point or the process of comparing your transition and like sort of a loss of former self, more so for your parents than you, it seems, and the loss of your niece and how that kind of all came together thematically and emotionally for you?
Sure. I don't have any particular feelings of loss about or that are related to transition. I think, you know, trans identity is really rich for metaphor and symbolism with, you know, with these ideas of loss, or the idea of like transformation or like letting go of something to become the new thing or whatever. But I'm much more of the sort of like of the ilk that you're like kind of always carrying the thing inside you. And so the thing never goes away. You know, there's no like before and after, right? And sometimes that's an easy way for people to understand it, but it's just not realistic. Especially the way people understand their gender, it takes many, many years to come to a place where you like are interested in engaging any kind of modification, if that's even what you want. I came of being trans at a certain age where like no one was taking hormones. And so there was all these trans guys that were not taking hormones, and it was just our culture. And so we're dealing with not passing constantly in the world for so long. And it's a very different world now. And it's a very different like approach. And like, you know, there was no such thing as non-binary. And, you know, at this point in time, there's not a lot of trans people left that are identifying as trans and are not doing a lot of body mod stuff or hormone stuff. And like, I just bring a really, I think my moment in time, my coming of age into my queerness brings a different perspective than most contemporary trans narratives people are getting. I know that's sort of like only loosely related to your question, but I just don't experience like loss or disconnect in that way. I feel like deep integration, and like, I don't subscribe to the like, I've always felt this way kind of thing, you know, because I haven't. Like, people change, like their feelings change all the time. And just because you make decisions about your body or your identity doesn't mean you can't change them again and again and again and again. And that's okay. For me, the loss I feel is a loss of childhood, which I think most people that are somewhat sensitive and romantic feel more strongly than some people, you know? But like, I do have a tendency towards, you know, rumination and nostalgia. And like, I know the nostalgia is like a dirty word, especially for filmmakers. You know, I find a certain poesis there, and I get trapped there in the archive, sort of, you know, of sorts. And that doesn't mean that I understand a specific before and after, but I do like this, like, this like comfortable slippage between the two, and the fact that they are the same thing. I think that's why I play with time so much in the film, and this idea that time is cyclical and that time is collapsing upon itself and is cascading always, and we're sort of like repeating things and reliving things. You know, when my parents say this line in the film about understanding, you know, or rather equating, you know, my being trans with Calla's death and this idea of like a dual loss, that was the first time I ever heard them say that. So it was really, it was shocking, you know, like, because the loss I had understood was the loss of, you know, I had a lot of sadness around not having a boyhood as a child, and that, you know, I missed a lot of kind of rites of passage and things like that, that I would have maybe liked to have had. But also, like, I think about them and I'm like, oh my God, it sounds awful to grow up as a little boy. Like, what a nightmare, you know, like having all this sort of like macho shit kind of like forced upon you. Like, I don't think that I don't want to be any different. I don't desire to be any different than who I am. And like, the way I grew up is the way I grew up, you know, but I think a lot of people work through that period of mourning around like not having had access to these certain things that you feel somehow connected to, whether that's socially constructed or not, because we can't really tell. It's still a feeling, so it's still valid. I mean, I think the question of loss is one of those things that it's like, it's always an interesting question. It's never like a yes, I subscribe to that, or no, I don't subscribe to that, you know. But I don't really like, there's this term dead name that is like a very common way people describe former names of trans people, like, oh, they dead named this person and it's so terrible or whatever. I'm just like, fuck that. Like, I mean, it's not cool to use someone's name they don't want to go by. That's just an asshole move. But the idea of like calling it a dead name has always rubbed me really, really wrong. Just because, like, I feel like that person is very much alive and is inside, and it feels like disrespectful to like insinuate that person is dead, you know, or whatever. There's just like really dense, ripe kind of like room for discourse and thought around the relationship between like transness and grief and death and change, you know. And I think that's part of the reason I just have a lot of patience for my parents throughout that process, because, you know, I'm not young and, you know, I've done a lot of the processing I need to process around that, like 20 years ago. My feelings and my responses are not as heightened as a younger person's might be, who has had less time to think through this stuff and process it and like literally exercise it out of their physical body, right? Because like there's so much going on in how we kind of like physically, how we're like processing trauma in the body and all this shit. So like it's really easy for folks to get kind of like really easily offended by everyone else not being able to hop on board right away with exactly what they want. I think I probably was a little bit more like that at an earlier point in my life. But at the point when I started making the film, you know, I already was sort of like, this is who I am. This is what I offer the world. Like, not everyone's going to be on board with it. But also, like, it's not my problem. Even though it was very upsetting to hear them make that analysis, there was still something that I gravitated towards about it and understood about their rationale that I was willing to hold space for enough to, like, you know, make it a central theme in my movie. It's complex for sure.
Yeah. this is just a personal aside, but it really is nice being like a grown-ass adult and having more control of your emotions. I can tell, like, I have some intense traumas from, you know, my past that are pretty different from yours too. But I was just talking to my boyfriend last night and he was just like, man, you have come like so far in how you can like process really difficult things versus just kind of being in more panic, like
absolutely
crying, like grasping absolutely at straws away. Now I can just like think about things and
mm-hmm
and
just sit with that more minute.
Yeah, and like have yeah a better understanding of the people in my life who like affected me and just yeah like I'm like, oh, now I'm like their age or so and can like yeah I don't know, to there's benefits to growing.
I was listening
older
to something for real, I was listening to something on NPR today, which there was this person that was just like talking a lot about the idea that it's more important to be curious than it is to be right. And I really loved that. And I think it's probably going to sit with me for a while because it's hard. It's so hard to do that. But I think, you know, in the process of talking to my family members in this film, that's what I was trying really hard to do that. I couldn't have put it in words as good as that reporter, storyteller, journalist person did. But I was like, yeah, that's exactly it. And like, that's how I want to behave in my life. And I don't succeed at it very often, but when I do, it's really awesome.
Yeah, that's a good trait, especially as an artist and a filmmaker, a good motto to live by. So I have experienced personally growing up being on camera in a documentary with my family, and then also filmed a documentary with my family myself as my like senior thesis back when I was in college at UW-Milwaukee. So I was interested to hear more about your personal experiences filming your family.
You know, I spent a lot of time like warming up the camera before I ever started doing any interviews. So like I was between jobs and I was staying with my folks for a couple months and I just started shooting around a lot. Shooting lots of landscape stuff, shooting outside, going to the woods, going to the water, you know, shooting us having dinner or whatever, just shooting a lot, but not asking any questions, just sort of like home movie style. And I did that for maybe like 3 or 4 months before I did any sit down interviews. And my dad did that a lot when we were kids. And I think it already had a vibe in the house a little bit where, I don't know, it didn't feel challenging. I'm not really a person that like points cameras at people. I'm not like a documentary person in that way. When I make films, they're, you know, usually specifically, I'm setting up scenarios to execute documentation. I'm not like randomly putting a camera on someone's face. So, you know, it required quite a bit of me getting comfortable too, because if I sense someone is feeling discomfort, my first impulse is to stop doing what I'm doing, which in some ways is good in some ways is not always great, right, for a cinematographer, even though I would never say I'm a cinematographer, but for shooting. So I don't know, there's like, I have a tendency to hold the camera down and just point it at someone and not look through it at all, because I'm not really interested in, I mean, the camera is an apparatus and is there between us, but like, I'm trying to like have an actual conversation with someone, you know, I'm not trying to like look through a lens at them. You know, sometimes that means I don't get the best shots. I don't get the, like, whatever. I don't have perfect framing or perfect light or any of that crap. I love beautiful images, but when it comes to like dealing with human beings, the human beings usually take precedence for me. I basically just like was very kind of conscious of everyone's concerns. You know, my sister didn't want to talk, so we didn't talk. She was fine to talk about other things. Like, she was happy to talk about us as kids, you know. She was fine to talk if it was like spur of the moment where I was like hanging out in the garage with her or something, but she was not interested in sit down interviews. So like, it's really just like figuring out where the comfort level is and then respecting it. My parents didn't mind sit down interviews at all. You know, I think a lot of this project for them has to do with like, you know, feeling like they went through so much suffering and didn't get anything out of it. You know, like they went through excruciating amounts of suffering and like went very deep into debt to like pay these lawyers. You know what I mean? It's just like, it's like being kicked in the face over and over and over again. And then the person who kicks you in the face just walks away and decides they're done one day. It's so deeply dissatisfying to just be like broke and sad at the end of the day, you know? And like, no apologies, nothing. I think a lot of this film for them is a little bit of justice, you know, and a way to kind of feel like someone gets to bear witness, whether it's me or whether it's an audience or whatever. And that's its own justice.
I've talked to a lot of filmmakers who different stories, but are making really difficult work like you're doing. And I think something that we don't talk about enough in like the filmmaking world, because there's so many documentaries, whether they're personal or not, that are talking about really, really tough things. And like, how do you cope with, you're making the film, you're editing the film, you're talking to me right now, doing press, You're going to film festivals. Like, how do you cope with that? And how is that for you? Like, you talk about, you know, you're just said your sister doesn't even want to talk about it at all. And here you are talking, just Reliving everything all the time. Like, how are you and how do you deal with that?
I honestly don't relive it most of the time. I did relive it just a little bit when I was like saying that piece, but you know, like most conversations I don't want to say most conversations don't get that deep, but like, you know, people often want to talk about the artistry of the film, and that's an easy thing for me to talk about. I think, you know, the making of it in terms of like looking at my own footage and like creating scene assemblies. And I mean, the scene where my sister, you know, has an incident in the bathroom, like I wasn't able to look at that for a long time because I was like so like busted by it. And I didn't even have it on video because there was no camera. It was only an audio track that I had rolling accidentally because I was like doing something with my nephew while we were setting up some gear. And I went upstairs while it was rolling. You know, it wasn't even something I knew was happening. But I did not want to listen to that audio for probably like 2 or 3 months after I recorded it. When I did listen to it, it was like, I don't know if... Have you ever been to an open casket funeral? So when you go to an open casket funeral, there's this tremendous amount of fear going into it to see the body. And you are like nervous, you don't want to do it. And you're sort of like pacing around the back of the funeral home. And then once you finally do it, you can't leave. You just want to stay with the person, even though it's not the person anymore. This is maybe like a weird analogy, but that's how the audio was. Like, I was so afraid to listen to it. And then when I listened to it, I just had to keep listening to it over and over again. It didn't lose its intensity right away, but it did eventually, you know. And I don't want to say that I like became desensitized to it, because I still, you know, have a little like cortisol spike when I hear it. But I definitely, like, you know, integrated it into my psyche, into my personhood, in a way where it didn't have to be a separate thing. It could be a thing that I was like, yes, I had that experience that happened, and I can look at it now and I can remember how intense I felt in that moment, and I can recognize that I'm feeling intense right now, but I'm not feeling the intensity I would have felt at the time it happened, you know? And for me, I think just process-based stuff, like having these conversations with my family members and putting myself in a creative environment with them was really important. I think, you know, not a lot of people get to, like, get to know their family members through an alternate lens. When you collaborate with someone, you get to know a lot more things about how their brain works. And I collaborate with friends all the time. And that's, like, a big part of my work is that I don't really work with professionals. I just, like, ask my friend to work with me because I want to spend time with my friend. And I also, like, only work on projects. That's all I do. So, like, my friends know if they want to spend time with me, they basically have to work on something. But, you know, like, that, like, collaborative mode is, like, a great way to sort of, like, meet someone anew. And I feel like not very many adult children get to engage that way with their adult siblings or their adult parents. You know, it's like when you go home, you're always the kid, and there's that sort of, like, stuckness that comes with the, you know, revisiting the place you're from. But there's also these, like, opportunities to sort of, like, almost meet someone for the first time. And I had that experience multiple times with my family members, which is really rewarding. I don't know, allows for some semblance of transformative justice. You know, like, we don't obviously get thousands and thousands of dollars back. Or, like, get the child back, or get someone who's not struggling with substances. Like, we don't get any of these sort of, like, payoffs, but, like, we do get this payoff of having had some new intimacy.
One thing I was thinking about while you were just talking, and that's come up in my life recently with regards to a documentary about my family, are feelings of shame and it kind of being, like, anyone can access that information now and watch, you know, clips and footage and sound or whatever. And I'm not even sure what my question is exactly, but I was thinking about that as you're talking about, like, the clip with your sister, and thinking about examples from my own life and my parents. So is this something that's come up, I guess, in conversations, like, with you and your sister? You're a family, and this notion of, like, some sense of, like, public shame, I guess. And I'm saying this in a way that makes it sound really bad, but, like, just sharing really hard parts of yourself with other people.
You know, I don't think my parents have any shame around any of it. And I certainly don't. I think my sister might struggle there. And, you know, she has not seen the film yet. And she asked not to see it because she thought it would just be really too hard for her to watch. And I think, yeah, it will make her sad. You know, it could be a setback. And, you know, the last time I talked to her about it, she didn't want to see it, but now she's sort of coming around, especially since my parents saw it in the theater last month. So now she maybe wants to see it. And I think I'm going to go home for the holidays and we're going to sit down and watch it together. And I'm going to prepare her for it in depth so that there's no surprises and there's, you know, nothing caught off guard. And I also just need, you know, she needs to know that it's constructed, right? It's like, it's positioned to do storytelling work. It's positioned to lead a viewer to a stage of resolution. And to do that, you know, you manipulate things. You know, it's not like there's things that are, like, blatantly untrue in the film, but, like, I think it is important for her to know that, like, hey, when I put this image next to this other image, here's what meaning is made from that. And so sort of, like, breaking down that process, I think, is going to be important to her viewing experience. You know, we're pretty fortunate in my family that, like, I mean, we're pretty resilient people, but we're also, like, this is the package, you know, take it or leave it. It doesn't get any better or smarter or more interesting or less interesting or whatever. Like, this is what I got. The great thing about the movie is that everyone gets to be terrible and wonderful at the same time, which is normal. You know, like, it's, like, the most normal to be terrible and wonderful at the same time. Everyone is. And I think it's weirder to, like, not acknowledge all the ways in which we're broken. So in that regard, barring what my sister's comments will be in the future, I don't think any of us really have feelings of shame or embarrassment, even though I know those are very different things. But, you know, what I do have is, like, a sense of protection and a sense of, like, not wanting people to see the film and think the wrong things. But that's part of the lack of control you have when you release something to an audience. You know, you don't have control over it, and people will see what they want to see regardless of what I want them to see. I don't know, I have complicated feelings about filming children. You know, like, that's legal guardian is consenting to it. They are consenting to it, even though they're not of age of consent, you know? So, like, I feel mostly okay about it. And I feel like the kids had fun too, which created another way for us to connect. But it definitely is one of those things where it's like, I don't know how they're going to feel about it when they're 20, you know? I'm sure when they're 13, they'll like hate it because they're teenagers. But like, the real question is, how will they feel about when they're 20 or when they're 25? It's certainly like not something I can predict, and also something I was obviously willing to risk, even though I think I wasn't thinking about it super, super consciously at the time.
You talk about not being able to control what audiences see in your film, but what are some things that, even if it's just like an emotional feeling that people walk away with, that you're hoping they take from it, or some ideas that you had in mind with why you wanted to share this story with other people?
At the end of the day, like, I want people to really think deeply about subjective truth and the sort of intersection of experiences, and also the ways that things don't just wrap up nicely for us and never will. Like, this film is very much a sort of like snapshot of a moment in time, but it doesn't attempt to tell you that, like, oh, now everyone's happy and sober and in good relationships and not having learning disabilities and whatever, you know? It's like, no, nothing really works that way. Two things, like, nothing exists in a vacuum. Everything is interdependent on everything else that's going on. And then also, like, there's no such thing as a happy ending. The only thing we have is each other. That's sort of like the only thing that the film can kind of fall back on. We will encounter sort of trauma after trauma throughout our lives. And like, really the only thing we have is the connections we make and maintain, even in the face of so many different subjective experiences and subjective truths, right? Like, we're all living our own version of a subjective truth. And the only way to move through that and still be in community is to sort of, you know, take a breath and have some patience and try to find common ground.
Yeah, I love that. I love storytelling, being able to just be like a portal to connect with each other. And like, I work for film festivals in my day job, and just like love the energy of people getting to like be in a theater together. Mm-hmm. And like have this like communal experience that, you know, and seeing a story that maybe is so incredibly far from their personal story, but being able to like feel the same thing that the person next to you is feeling, I think is really beautiful. Yeah. I'm excited for people to see this film, and I feel like they're going to tap into places that they maybe haven't before or in a long time. Yeah.
I did get I don't remember who it was from, but it was a message via someone that was like, but it wasn't to me. It was like to someone else via someone else. You know, it was like, I left that movie and I had to go call my mom or something like that, you know? And I'm just like, that's awesome. I love that takeaway.
Thank you so much. This was like more intense of a conversation than I intended it to be. So thank you.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
You can rent North by Current on Apple TV or iTunes, or watch on Fandor through Amazon Prime. You can also follow the filmmaker on Instagram at Angelo Madsen. The music is Lost and Bound by Taline Kali, and she's currently on tour, so check her out to see if she's coming to your city at Taline Kali. The artwork for the podcast is by Whitney Salgado, and I'm your host, Dawn Borchardt.